You're listening to Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman. Minoru Yamasaki was one of the most prominent American architects of the 20th century. His best-known work was the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center, but he made his mark on several U.S. cities, Detroit, St. Louis, and of course, his hometown of Seattle, where he designed both the Pacific Science Center and Rainier Tower. Now, Minoru Yamasaki's granddaughter, Katie Yamasaki, is sharing his legacy with a new generation of would-be architects. She's the author and illustrator of Shapes, Lines, and Light, My Grandfather's American Journey, a new picture book about the architect. Katie says that what people often miss about Minoru Yamasaki is the guiding ethos of his work, a devotion to serenity, surprise, and delight. Katie spoke with Soundside producer Noel Gasca about the process of writing about her grandfather and also the experience of racism and exclusion that shaped one of the most famous architects of the 20th century.
When did you become aware of your grandfather's, place in the architecture world?
It's interesting to think about his place in the architecture world because he's kind of most known for two projects at least represent him in terms of his artistry and in terms of kind of who he was as a person, one being the World Trade Center and one being Pruitt-Igoe. And, in places like Seattle and in places like Detroit, he's extremely famous. But if you go to architecture schools around the country, it wasn't until fairly recently that his work was even taught. I would meet people who worked in architecture and they would say things like, Yamasaki, World Trade Center and Pruitt-Igoe, what a tricky legacy. And I was thinking, in my life, I kind of knew him as this larger than life presence for his accomplishments, but that wasn't necessarily how the world encountered him. And I wanted to kind of create a space in this book for exploring who he was as an artist and getting to understand his intentions with his work, especially in the context that he grew up in as a Japanese-American man in this country.
Mm-hmm. How long have you wanted to tell the story of your grandfather's life? And why did you decide to tell this story through the format of a children's picture book in particular?
I've wanted to tell this story for a very long time. I think that, when we were growing up, we lived in a factory town north of Detroit. And it was very specifically an anti-Japanese place at an anti-Japanese time. It was during the recession. Vincent Chin was murdered when I was 6 years old. It was kind of like a tricky place to grow up as, mixed race Japanese American family. But it was also strange because we knew our grandfather was famous. And so there was this kind of feeling of being at odds with the popular narrative of what it was to be Japanese and who the Japanese were. But I've always wanted to kind of tell his story because the backstory of being Japanese American, growing up in this country, being born in 1912 and kind of building a career in post-war America when the Japanese American community has lost everything, it's a profound story. And I started graduate school at the School of Visual Arts in 2001. 9/11 was like our second day of school. And I remember watching as his buildings, the World Trade Center, got turned into, over time, this piece of pro-war propaganda for a war that we didn't agree with and a war that we didn't support. And it made me think a lot about the symbols that we make and the stories that are told about work when it might not be the story that we want. And I really wanted to tell his story at that time, but I also really wanted to distance his story from the story of 9/11. And so I waited for quite a long time. And during that time, in maybe 2006 or 2007, I started working on his story, but it's still, it's when I look back at early drafts, it centered the World Trade Center a lot. And although that was his crowning kind of professional accomplishment, it really wasn't what was at the heart of his work, which was making buildings at a human scale that allowed people to experience these feelings of, in his words, serenity, surprise, and delight. It's really well exemplified kind of here at the Pacific Science Center, this feeling of peace and this feeling of awe that you can have in a space. And I think growing up at the time he grew up, when a lot of spaces that he would enter were not spaces that were designed with him in mind. And in fact, they were kind of spaces that excluded him or excluded his family. He wanted to create spaces that made people feel welcome, whether they were university buildings or travel hubs. He wanted people to feel that they could sit in a quiet space and think their best thoughts or feel seen or feel fully human, which as a person who funded their way through college by working in the salmon canneries in Alaska, you know, in the 1930s. It wasn't a kind of a luxury of feeling fully human and feeling fully seen that he was enabled, mm-hmm. that he was allowed.
Mm-hmm. Like you mentioned, your grandfather, Minoru, was born in Seattle's Japantown. He grew up in Yesler Hill, which is now known as Yesler Terrace. And I'm wondering if you could tell me a little bit more about what his early childhood and life was like here in Seattle.
You know, he was born in 1912, and I think that being a part of this vibrant Japantown for him was incredibly powerful, because where he would go, the people he engaged with as a young child, they looked like him. It was in a community that was familiar to him. It was full of people who spoke the same language that his parents spoke. The outside world outside of that community was a different story. You know, if he wanted to go swimming with his friends, he couldn't swim in the public pools. If they wanted to go to a movie, they couldn't sit in the lower level of the theater. They had to sit up in the balcony. Such was the case with all Japanese Americans at that time. They couldn't own property. There was like an inside the community feeling, and then there was an outside of the community feeling. And I think that that was something that he struggled with, but I think that it provided him the feeling of knowing that there is this feeling of welcome and of being seen that he wanted to have in his life and in the world. So as he went through his life and things would happen, like he went to University of Washington and he was the top architecture student to kind of graduate from the program. And when he graduated, up until his graduation, this architecture school had always provided a full scholarship for the top architecture students to go and study at the Society of Beaux-Arts in Paris. And until his year, you know, it had always happened. And then they canceled it his year so that they wouldn't have to give it to him. Mm. You know, and it was kind of like so many things of that nature. You know, in my opinion, kind of my thesis is that it informed the kind of spaces that he wanted to create and the kind of world that he wanted to live in, mm-hmm. you know. And I think that, you know, when you look at, for example, Pacific Science Center and you look at the outside spaces that he focused on, there was this value of the built environment that was beyond the kind of practical necessity of four walls and a roof, mm-hmm. but it was kind of valuing the emotional experience of being in a space and kind of demanding that of the developer as well, that we're also going to build this. And this doesn't serve the same function, but it serves a function of the imagination and a function of the spirit.
I mean, your grandfather's presence is still felt in this city today. You mentioned the Seattle Science Center. There's also the Rainier Tower, you know, here in Seattle. He gave back to this city, you know, and the city was not always kind and welcoming to him or his family or Japanese Americans. Mm. I guess I'm wondering how your grandfather's relationship with his home, with this city, evolved over time.
You know, I wish that that was a question that I could ask him as an adult. When I read his writings, you know, from his own autobiography, A Life in Architecture, how he speaks about his experience with racism and the experience of being Asian American, it's very thoughtful and very reflective. And I think that he can separate people from a city. He can separate government from community. And I think that he can see things, and he was able to see things pretty clearly and kind of really go to the essence. And this is what I was trying to do with this book, is kind of get at the heart of and get at the essence of his work, which was to, no matter who you were, to provide a human experience that no matter where you come from, that your experience in a space has incredible value. And I wonder, he worked so much and he worked so hard, and he sometimes to the detriment of his health, you know, he worked with a mission that he would be seen and that his life would have value. And sometimes I wonder, you know, what would his career have been like had he grown up in a place, in a country, at a time that saw his life as having inherent value for the simple fact of his mm-hmm. existence. Mm-hmm. And that's a conversation I'm interested in having with children who I share the book with. How do we start out our journey into whatever field we want, knowing that our life has value and we don't need to be the best, build the tallest, run the fastest to prove our worth? We just have to live on this planet and figure out how we can have a life of meaning. Mm-hmm. You had asked a little while ago about why children's books, and children's books for me, you know, this is my eighth book. And for me, they're kind of the best way for me to have conversations with the primary audience who I want to talk to, who are children, teachers, parents, you know, kind of everyday people, about things that sometimes can be hard to talk about. I do a lot of work around communities who are impacted by incarceration, children who have parents who are incarcerated, you know, and even in my grandfather's story, there's a lot about loss of civil liberties, loss of kind of one's humanity. And I find children's books to be a wonderful way to have these tricky conversations because children come to the book with an open heart, you know, and they also come to the book with an emotional sensitivity and a lack of judgment of the kind of emotional experience of a subject in a story. Mm. So, you know, a lot of people might think kids need to read happy books or kids need to read, you know, silly books. And, you know, all that can be true. But also, kids are so aware of the full range of human emotion. They haven't had it tamped down yet.
So real, but also very tender.
Yeah.
In the book, you write about the ethos that drove your grandfather's work. And you write, quote, "The spaces he built connected to the humanity of everyday people, workplaces, learning spaces, travel hubs, and sacred spots to gather were filled with serenity, surprise, and delight." Why do you think your grandfather was inspired by those three words?
I think he knew that everybody, no matter your life circumstances, deserves those three things: serenity, surprise, and delight. And it's a human desire to have all of those things, you know, and that, you know, in the way that his mind worked, in the way that he had the capacity to build spaces, that was his way to contribute, you know. And when he would make spaces at universities or at airports or at religious sacred spots, that was his way that he could provide people maybe what he wasn't always allowed to experience when he was a young man himself, or what his parents as immigrants were allowed to experience. His father, you know, worked his entire life stocking shoes in the back of shoe stores. And, you know, he was an incredible worker, but he was never allowed to sell the shoes, be out on the floor. And you think about how our lives are enriched by these elements of peace or of surprise and of delight. And I think that at his best and at his most ideal, that those were the things that he wanted to bring to the world. Those were the gifts he knew he could impart. After he did the World Trade Center, when that project happened, he had to grow his office by a lot. Kind of, he had to hire so many more architects and so many more people to support the scope of that project. So when it was done, his office was then really big and really full of people that still needed employment, you know, and he took that really seriously. So then he had to kind of take on bigger projects that were more corporate, you know, maybe a little bit less of the kind of magical work that I most often refer to is stuff that happened in the 1950s and 60s. And I think that he also has had conversations with my father in particular about how to stay small, that may have been in the best interest of his artistry. But I think that it's amazing to me what he was able to do with the work that he did, especially in his early career, and how one can transform an experience of being denied certain things. You know, it's not lost on me that, like, the workspaces he experienced prior to being an architect were mostly salmon canneries, 18-hour work days, you know, I mean, conditions that would be absolutely illegal today. Mm-hmm. No ventilation, no lighting, you know, just completely kind of criminal circumstances. And what he wanted, he built these office buildings that were just full of windows, full of light, full of curious shapes that kind of challenge your emotional experience and make you feel, you know, these elements of serenity, surprise, and delight. But I think that when it comes to the best of his work, those were the qualities he most wanted to bring to the people who inhabited the spaces.
Yeah. It sounds like, you know, he absolutely drew on his own lived experience and wanted to bring humanity into architecture in a sense and into the buildings that he was creating.
Yeah.
And wanted his buildings, in a sense, to recognize other people's humanity.
Right. And the trend at the time that he was working was a lot of the time to kind of overwhelm or amaze or intimidate. He was often criticized by architecture critics for being overly decorative. A lot of the reviews would be kind of, you know, you can't really see them other than being pretty racist when they would start a review by talking about his body and his small stature, his diminutive frame, and his kind of effeminate forms in an effort to kind of emasculate him and emasculate his work, which is just kind of breathtaking and heartbreaking to read, because all of that stuff, it lands really hard, you know, when you're trying to prove your worth and find your place in the world and make these spaces that you have had to fight so hard for. He was somebody who came from a public university into the elite white world of architecture when there were no other non-white architects working other than maybe I.M. Pei, who came from an elite Ivy League school. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, he was entering a world that did not want him there. Mm-hmm. So those reviews, when I read them, kind of makes my blood boil and it also my heart break at the same time.
I read the Time piece, the Time cover story that was published about your grandfather. And like you touched on, you know, the writer mentions his body shape and his weight and details that have no relevance to the structures that he made or really the story itself. I'm curious, as a family member, you're reading about your grandfather. How does that make you feel?
You know, I think that it is enraging to read those things, but it's also enraging the lack of material about him. Like when I was growing up in my school library, there was no book or biography about any Asian or Asian American, zero. There were no biographies about brown or black people outside of Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks. You know, and I think that that is the story of so many schools throughout the country and so many people who were raised, you know, in the 80s and 90s. But, you know, it was also just a specifically anti-Japanese part of the country that we grew up in. But, you know, the question is, who is writing the reviews and who are the gatekeepers of whatever community that is? And I wonder, in architecture, to me, architecture is not an enviable field to be in. The hours that people work, the brutal schooling, the exams that they have to take to get licensed, it is not an enviable field. But I do wonder just kind of who the gatekeepers are and why they were just so hell-bent on writing about him in that way. Mm-hmm. You know, and whenever I read those critiques, I know that it landed really hard on him. But then I also think about how was that for the rest of my family, for my dad and my aunt and my uncle, and for my grandmother, when you have a father who is working so hard to prove his place in the world. And what is the emotional impact on the family when these racist reviews come on home? You know, what happens then?
You're really honest in the book about the pressure that your grandfather experienced and the low points in his career. I'm wondering what kind of sacrifices your grandfather had to make in order to succeed and really just survive in a field that was often very hostile towards him because of his race.
Yeah. You know, and I won't get so into so much of the personal family details of this, but there were incredible sacrifices. And I think that one thing, you know, there's a picture in the book of a family dinner, of everybody eating dinner together. And my father kind of described that and how it would be, because their grandparents also, his parents lived with them as well. But it was kind of like, well, on the nights that he was able to come home for dinner, which was rare, you know, the amount of time he spent away from the family, the amount of coffee that he drank, and the ways that he made himself continue to go and move forward. It's the old adage of like working twice as hard. You know, I would say that rang 100% true for him. And, you know, I think that the sacrifice largely has to do with his own health and also his own ability to be present with his family. Towards the end of his life, when he was slowing down, he was very much connected with his family. But I think that there was a generational component to it. There was a cultural component to it. There was a gender component to it. But the way of working at that time, it just wasn't healthy. And the way of feeling the need to prove one's worth in this society also just wasn't healthy. And it was a sacrifice that I think he made in being so driven to do the work that he was doing and to prove his worth.
Mm-hmm. Just as an aside, looking at the pictures and reading that part in the book in particular, it made me think about my own grandfather and the toll and the impact that years and years and decades of physical labor have had on his body. Like, it just brought, I don't know, made me think of him, made me, again, take a step back and reflect the sacrifices that he's made that I haven't really been able to conceptualize until I became an adult, you know,
yeah,
thinking
absolutely.
About that. As a kid, I just thought, you know, he worked a lot to help to put food on the table. Uh-huh. And now as an adult, I think about how, no, he had to work twice as hard to get just incrementally a little bit further.
Just know? To the bare minimum. And, you know, and you think about how that all lives in your body and how you pass that urgency down to your family, you know, that the stakes are so high.
Mm.
And I know that for my grandfather, what he felt was that he had to be the best in the world, which is an arbitrary and useless measure, you know, but it was something that he put upon himself, was that I need to be the best in the world. And why be the best in the world when you could be the best in the history of the world?
Mm.
You know, he would say that. And you could feel that pressure. You know, why would somebody grow thinking that? It doesn't set you up for a life of fulfillment, that's for sure, because you could never measure that. And I know that in response, like, my own father has definitely raised us to find a life of meaning and then don't judge yourself on anything. Everything you do is fantastic, you know? And I, you know, I feel so grateful to that, because when I approach my projects, I don't have this voice of like, nothing that I do is going to be good enough. I have to prove myself, mm-hmm. which I think is the voice that my grandfather may have heard, mm-hmm. that he constantly had to prove himself. I hear this voice of like, all right, great job. You know, that seems really meaningful, you know, and I appreciate that that's the voice that my father has kind of instilled. And it's largely, I think, in response to what he heard at home growing up.
As an artist and as a granddaughter, you're telling a very personal story. I'm wondering what it has meant for you to revisit your grandfather's life and career, but also reinterpret it in your own style and in your mm-hmm. own voice.
You know, it has been a really emotional project. And I think that the first part about that in terms of being a granddaughter is that I'm one of 8 grandchildren. So as much as I'm retelling the story and interpreting it, it's also the story of my cousins and my aunt and uncles. And, you know, as much as I have this telling and I have this platform, they also have, everybody had their own experiences with him and everybody had their own life with him. And for me, what I was trying to do the most was extract the spirit of his work and focus on that in the context that he lived, in the context of the world that he lived at that time. And I think that with the world, how it's been, you know, since 2020, when all of the Asian hate stuff has risen to the top, there have been so many triggers of just what the experience of being Asian American has always been like in this country. It's mm-hmm. been in the center of the news for the first time in my lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were just so many stories that came out that made me feel like, are we living in the twilight zone? You know, when I look at my grandfather's life story and what he experienced, and then when I hear about things that are happening on a daily basis right now in the Asian community, it was emotional and it was heartbreaking, but it was also wonderful because my family really has so loved the book and felt so connected and felt like in some cases that there were things in his story that they may not have known that I got from other sources. At the end of the day, what you always hope is that there are just more and more stories about more and more people that can deepen the texture and the diversity of the Asian American story in this country. So it's been emotional and it's been a journey, but I feel like it's been really worthwhile.
That was Katie Yamasaki speaking with Soundside producer Noelle Gaska about her book Shapes, Lines, and Light. Thanks for listening to Soundside. Don't forget you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 Seattle at noon and 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday, or anytime right here online at KUOW.org, or of course on your favorite podcast app.